Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com/NSS to save 20% on any order. And by Hover. Register a domain name with Hover and build your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and save 10% off your first purchase. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/NSS.
A giant armored razor blade inside a neural network, and which camera phone has the best portrait mode? Live from the Twit East Side Studios in beautiful Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
Welcome to New Screensavers, episode 133, December 2nd, 2017. I am Leo Laporte.
I am Father Robert Ballasser.
I call him the Pope's favorite maker, or macher. The Pope would probably say macher.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Yeah, because the Pope likes Yiddish.
Yeah.
We're here. We're gathered here today to talk about technology, saving the world one computer at a time, weird cosplay.
In a galaxy far, far away.
In a galaxy far, far away, all sorts of stuff. There is some really interesting stuff going on. First, we're going to meet at what you saw, a maker extraordinaire.
I'm kind of blown away, really. It's amazing.
I don't think even the word cosplay is a... sounds trivial. It's not cosplay. This is like... make a movie.
This is full-on costuming.
Yeah. Costuming. That's a better way. We're going to talk... he's got stuff from Fallout. He's got stuff from Evolve. The reason we found out about him, he made in Petaluma, we have one of those big, the big power transforming plant, where they have all the wiring and stuff.
Substation.
And there's just a, what is it called?
Substation.
Thank you.
Electrical power,
substation.
Power Dewey thingy.
And I always thought it was a little strange because it's got a giant plug socket on it and a plug. And I thought, really, is that, there it is. Is that how they distribute it? But no, that's a work of art. And he made it. And I think it's the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. We'll talk in just a bit. To Sean Thorson.
Don't forget, we've also got something for all the geeks out there who want to know a little something about neural learning, deep learning, machine learning. Everything that you might have heard over the last couple of years, it's culminating into something that's awesome, and it involves Mario Kart. That's right. We've got YouTuber Seth Bling, who's going to show us how they created not one, but two neural networks to compete in that classic video game.
Wow. Yeah. Also coming up, there's more? Yes. This is something I've wanted to do for a long time, and thank you, Jason Howell, for doing it. He took five of the best new smartphones and compared the photography skills of each. Two iPhones, a Pixel 2 XL, a Galaxy Note 8, and the OnePlus 5T. What's the best camera phone? We're going to find out definitively. Finally, lay rest to all of this.
Well, at least for now. Now, something that's not going to be laid to rest is what the best VR game is out there.
Ooh.
Leo, this holiday season is completely packed. Everything from the Oculus to the HTC Vive to the brand new Windows Mixed Reality environment. There's a lot of VR stuff out there, and we've got Sam Moscovich who's going to come in and give us the rundown on all the VR goodness.
And we've got, of course, questions and answers in our mailbag and from Call for Help viewers. But first, let's talk about the news of the week. We were doing Mac Break Weekly.
This is kind of
Andy Inaka, Renee Ritchie, and I. And somebody, maybe Patrick Delahanty, tweeted, and Patrick in the chat room said, there's a kind of a problem. Somebody tweeted that if you were in Mac OS High Sierra, the latest version of the Macintosh operating system, you could log in or unlock system preference panes. You could do anything by entering root as the username and a blank password. First time it would say no. Second time it would say, okay, come on in.
Now, the scary thing about this, Leo, is the fact that when I first heard about it, I thought, this has got to be a joke. It can't be true. And then I tried it, and it was one of these, no. It's, no.
It worked!
It works not just local, because people were at first saying, well, you have to be in front of the computer. No, if that computer had been set up for a remote connection.
If you had SSH turned on.
Yeah. So
would it work? Because I was wondering.
It did.
You could root blank with SSH.
At the school that I was living at in San Francisco, I'm normally firewalled from the school, but I kind of plugged in, and I just did a quick scan, found about 36 Macs. Our IT department is really good about updating, and I hit 3 or 4 of them, and it worked every single time. It was kind of devastating because now, as an IT person, if your Mac was on that version of High Sierra, the unpatched version, you just have to assume that something bad has happened to it.
You have to say, well, we don't know how long this has been known for. It's been a problem for, it must have been weeks, right? But just discovered on Tuesday. We were able to quickly offer a workaround. Normally in a Mac, the root account is not enabled. This bug enabled it,
I guess. Which is strange.
And there was never a password assigned to it, so it made it possible to log in as root blank. If you had fast user switching turned on, somebody could have even logged into a locked machine. It's as bad as you can get. Our workaround was very simple, which was just to give a password to the root account.
Right.
But that obviously isn't a long-term solution. Well, maybe it is, actually. But in any event, Apple did something I didn't even know they could do. They pushed out an update that was automatically applied.
That was the strange part. People are like, wait, you could do that?
It's fixed. They pushed out an update. They just fixed it. Yeah. Without warning or anything, it just was fixed. Then, in their infinite wisdom, thank you, Craig Federighi, they pushed out an update to High Sierra that broke the fix.
This is, great. That's awesome. Thank you. Well done.
So,
Leo, I am disturbed because this is not the only time this has happened. I mean, Windows computers are famous for always running as root.
Okay. Well, we talked about this. In XP, for instance, you could enter administrator blank and log in.
Correct.
Right? And that was nice because people often forgot their passwords.
Right.
But that I don't think there was a lot of attention paid to it because previous versions of Windows, 95 and 98, you could log in without a password.
No,
there was no security at all.
It
wasn't even that. It wasn't a multi-user operating system. They just didn't.
The security feature was the on-off switch.
Yeah. So I think we got to XP, which was a true multi-user operating system and supposedly more secure. And people said, so there's a blank user password. No big deal. They fixed that subsequently.
Right.
I have to say, I have never seen a more serious flaw. We should point out that people did have to have physical access to your Mac, or you had to turn on SSH.
Right, if you had turned that on. Most don't, but we do because we like remote administration.
Yeah, but so now what I'm unclear on is how many machines are not patched now, because they sent out a patch that was automatic to everybody. They sent out an update, which you had to apply, and then it broke. Did they send out a fix to the fix? And then what I have been hearing is that you have to reboot.
Yes.
And this is something a lot of Mac users never do.
Most computers don't anymore. This Windows machine probably hasn't rebooted since the fall creators update.
Right. So you can re-download the fix. You might want to do that.
Yeah.
And then reboot your machine and then just chalk it up to what the hell.
But Leo,
I don't understand how that could happen.
We don't expect this from Apple. I mean, this is why people pay premium for it, because Apple watches for this sort of
stuff. There's more. So they fixed the stupid calculator bug. They did fix that, I'm happy to say, where you could, if you added 1 plus 2 plus 3 and you did it just a little too fast, the calculator would say 24 so instead of 6. So, but they fixed that. But then when they fixed that, they broke something else. And if you have an iPhone that is not, they just pushed out an update. Let me give you the current update, which is 11.2. If you are running an 11.1.3, your phone will crash today.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Did it work, Jerry? Did your phone crash? Not yet.
Okay, now here's the thing.
Oh, you got to do that update.
It does relate to a third-party app, so the way that the data is served a third-party app. So you have to have certain third-party apps that are going to interpret that data wrong. Yeah.
Date math is so hard.
It is, right?
It's so difficult.
You go 12.1 and then 12.2.
Oh, my God. That's not all. There's more.
Oh, good.
No, there's not.
This, I think, you know, security-wise, this was just an anomalous week for Apple. I don't like to pile on, but this was weird.
I know you did. Thank you for doing security now for me on Tuesday, because I ran out of here to go celebrate my birthday in the Big Apple.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you. But I know you and Steve talked about this. Steve is so mad at iOS 11 in general. He says it's never worked well. I haven't had those problems. I think iOS 11 has worked fine on my iPhone 8 and 10. But he, for some reason, has all sorts of... there are cosmetic issues.
Yeah.
And I've heard from a lot of people who've had issues, the dock getting stuck and all sorts of weird things. So
there's one really good way to fix it.
What's that?
Go buy an iPhone 10.
Does that fix it?
Probably.
No. Steve has an iPhone 10. I thought you were going to say, go buy a Pixel 2 XL. But, you know, I feel like Apple is taking its eye off the ball just a little bit.
I think so.
Focus, Apple. Focus.
Well, this is what happens when so much of their profit, it's at, what, 96% now, comes from one thing, the iPhone. And so all of the other products are going to get, they're not getting short shrift, but they're definitely not going to get the lion's share of attention. So the Mac OS, I can understand. That little bug, okay, that got past Q&A. But the fact that iOS 11 has been buggy for some people, that's...
And for many, like, how many we have...
I know.
Updates, 11, 11.01, 11.0. I mean, four or five updates, right? Now we're at 11.2. Get the latest.
Come
maybe
on,
that'll
Apple.
Fix things. And
come
they
on.
Did. But the calculator, it works. It works. So you can do it for your... You can use it for your taxes. I got up this morning and saw the strangest thing. Can you show this front page of Reddit... So this is not there anymore. I wish it were. These are the top stories on Reddit based on karma. Senator Cory Gardner, he sold me Denver and all of Colorado to the telecom lobby for $95,000. Then this is Representative Gregory Walden. He sold me and my fellow Oregonians in this nation to the telecom lobby for the price of $155,000.
These are real numbers, by the way, folks. This is how much they've received.
So somehow Reddit does this. It's amazing. Redditors got together and they managed to arrange the karma in such a way that the entire front page of Reddit was filled with actual members of Congress and the amount of money the telecom lobby had paid to them. The only thing I come up with is some of these guys are cheap. Senator Shelley Moore Capito, she sold out to
24
the...
24 grand?
24 grand?
Come on,
what are you talking
Senator.
About? That's... Hold out for more, Shelley. You can get more. Look, some of these guys got $155,000.
I mean, I just checked my list. A senatorial vote is worth at least 60 grand.
I think it should be.
It's destroying the market.
Anyway, yeah. December 14th, everybody protest. The problem is there's so many things to protest now. It's almost like I throw up my hands. I don't know what to do.
Well,
right?
Here's the thing. Under the previous FCC chairman, Wheeler, remember, he did try to roll out paid prioritized lanes. There was a huge public outcry, and he listened. And he said, okay, we're not going to do that. With this new chairman, he's made it abundantly clear that he doesn't care what you think. He's not listening to comments. He's not taking comments.
Well, and there were more than, we think, a million comments that were fake comments in favor of abandoning net neutrality. And syntactic analysis has shown that those comments were created by mail merge. And and those probably were phony. You can. There is a database you can search for your name. Make sure that nobody commented in your name in vain. I checked. Because I had commented saying this would be very bad for Twit. Well, net neutrality protects innovators like Twit against the big incumbents who can afford to pay, you know, ISPs for access to you. I can't do that. And it might mean that, well, you get Netflix cheap, you get Amazon cheap, but Twit, well, that's going to cost you. And I don't think that that's a good thing for anybody.
The problem is there's a fundamental misunderstanding of how the internet works. Last time around, when they tried to do this, the phrase was free ride. We've got to stop the free riders. And wait a minute.
We're paying for it.
I pay for my access. Yeah. The provider pays for their access. They pay for all the bandwidth they use. So we're paying three times for the same bit of information. How many more times do we have to pay? And then with Pi, I mean, the comments he's made recently, it shows he doesn't actually know how the internet
he says
works.
There wouldn't be a problem except for share.
Yeah.
What?
You know, his argument, the latest argument that he made, why we need to get rid of net neutrality, because we have to preserve all the freedom of speech, because right now we have providers who can choose not to host certain types of content because it violates their standards. Well, folks, net neutrality has nothing to do with that.
Yeah, he's blaming Twitter. He's saying we've got to come down on Twitter. He says Cher and the guy who plays the Hulk have been ginning up this fear-mongering and hysteria. It's all Cher's fault against net neutrality.
Yeah. And in the meantime, we already have an example. Net neutrality is not even
Mark
dead
Ruffalo.
Yet. It's going to die on the 14th.
Alyssa Milano. It's all her fault.
You've got Charter right now because they're being sued by the New York AG because they misdelivered. They didn't deliver what they had sold. And Charter is now saying, well, net neutrality is about to die. And one of the things about the way Pai is doing it is he's going to preempt state rights. So you've got a major ISP essentially saying, the states have no power over us.
Yeah.
They can't tell us what we can and cannot do. Yeah. That's wrong.
And then
I'm
companies
sorry.
Like AT&T, which blocked FaceTime, are conveniently forgetting, oh, we would never do anything like that.
And Comcast is like, we would never throttle
Netflix. Slow down
Netflix. We did, but we wouldn't.
We wouldn't, not anymore.
Trust us.
Well, maybe we would.
Okay.
Coming up, we're going to talk. Cher, it's Cher's fault. I blame Cher.
Well, I'm pretty sure
she's ginning up all this net neutrality stuff. We'll talk machine learning for video games with Seth. Now, is his name Bling or Bing?
I like Bling, but I don't know. We're going to find out.
It's not his real name. Seth Bling will join us in just a little bit. But first, a word from our sponsor. And I know the holidays are coming, and you're probably casting around for something to get a geek in your life, or maybe a non-geek. In your life, I've got the perfect stocking stuffer. No matter what else you give them, whether it's a video, you know, a beautiful Nintendo Switch or an iPhone, you're going to want to give them a tracker to go along with it. Because tracker keeps you from losing the stuff you have. It's a coin-sized Bluetooth tracking device. Tiny. This is the new Tracker Pixel. Look how small that is. It's the size of a dime. Weighs about the same, and it has LED lights all around the ring. It comes in all different colors, very decorative. And then what's great about the Tracker Pixel is you attach that to your keys, and you can't find your keys. You go to the Tracker app on your phone, you press a button, the keys start screaming out loud, and the lights go around and around. So if they fell down in a crack in the sofa, it's easy to find them. But here's the best part. Tracker has the world's largest crowd locate network. Every single person who has the tracker is helping you find your stuff. And that's a lot of people. 5 million trackers sold so far. So that means there's people all over the world who have the tracker app on their phone. If your keys, let's say you leave them on the beach. The tracker app will say, well, last time I saw him was on the beach. But what if some good Samaritan comes along, picks your keys up, puts them in his pocket, and flies to Madagascar? Forgets, right?
He's they're gone, Leo. They're gone.
They're gone. They're gone. Well, the tracker app, because it's Bluetooth, it only works at 100 feet or 150 feet from the... But everybody in Madagascar has trackers. Whenever they walk by your keys, you turn it on and it says, hey, I just saw your keys in Madagascar. That is awesome. Put it on your bike. Put it in your luggage. Put it everywhere. You'll never lose it again. It's the lightest Bluetooth tracking device in the market. And even as small as the Tracker Pixel is, even that has replaceable batteries, which is something a lot of other Bluetooth trackers will not do. You have to throw them out when the battery runs out, not the trackers. You just put in a new battery and you're good to go for another year. I love the two-way separation alerts. If I leave my keys behind, my phone yells at me. Leave my phone behind, my keys yell at me. That is, for somebody who leaves his phones and keys around, that's a really nice thing. And you can even use their 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you give it to the kids and they don't like it, you can get your money back. But you know what? If you've got kids, you know. Mom, I lost my phone. Mom, the remote control's gone. You know you need the tracker. The tracker.com/NSS. We're going to give you 20% off your order. That's a good deal, even if it's not your first order. 20% off.
I could have used this when I was a kid. I was always losing my dad's
Where are my shoes?
Yeah.
You tie these into the shoelaces of the shoes, and you will never lose your shoes again. TheTracker.com, TheTracker.com/NSS. You're going to get 20% off your order when you go to TheTracker.com/NSS. So load up the cart. Get the Tracker Bravo. That's the anodized aluminum one. Get the Tracker Pixel. Get all sorts of like lanyards and different stuff you can get. Great stocking stuffers. TheTracker.com/NSS for 20% off. TheTracker.com/NSS. We thank you so much for making the new screensavers possible and for helping me. I have it. You know what I do is I have it on my keys. I have it on my briefcase. I have it in my glasses case.
I have one on my gig bag now because I store that in the common room on the ground floor of our residence. And the last one I had walked away.
Hey, let's get Seth on. I think it's Seth Bling. Am I saying that right, Seth?
Yeah, Seth Bling. There you go.
That's not your real name, I'm guessing.
No, it's not. Actually, Seth Bing is a little bit inappropriate, though. I used to work for Bing.
Did you really?
Bing is my default SEO.
Really?
So, yeah.
You worked?
Well, so, I actually used Google most of the time when I was working there. But
don't tell anybody.
I don't work there anymore. It's okay.
I have like 150,000 Bing points. At some point, I'm probably going to have to use those.
So you're a coder, and I take it that's what you were doing at Bing.
Yeah.
But also a YouTuber, and you did something I think that is the most cool thing ever. You taught a game to play itself.
This is straight out of War Games, by the way, which is awesome. Thank you very much for this.
Shall we play Mario Kart?
Well, actually, at first it taught itself how to play.
Okay, that's a little scary, actually.
So there's been I've done two sort of machine learning projects with neural networks. For Mario, different versions of Mario. The first one is Mar.io. That was a couple of years ago.
I remember that one. So it was that you're actually running through Super Mario World.
Yeah.
And now how do you so how does that work? You just let it play and you tell it the goal. The goal is to get to the end of the level and you just say play until you figure it out?
Yeah, it's so this one uses an evolutionary algorithm. So it's actually it's very close to the way that basic organisms evolved. And,
I remember a screensaver, Brevwalker. Remember that? Where you'd get a box with four legs.
Oh, right, yes.
And it was just, it couldn't walk, and you'd say, you're trying to maximize the distance. It was a screensaver, and it would get a little farther every day.
Yeah, that's about what this is like, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now, did you have to play in order for it to learn how to play?
I didn't touch the controller at all.
Wow.
All this that you're seeing on screen, this is all decisions being made just by a neural network. So it's just this program running what amounts to a mathematical model of a brain. And it's a very simple brain. You can actually see on the screen in the middle, there's these neurons. There's only like five of them in the version that you're seeing right now. It's this tiny brain. But it's got some sort of instincts about what to do in different situations. It can sort of see a version of the screen that's very simplified, which is what's on the left side of the screen. It can see the simplified version of the screen, makes these really decisions based on very simple computations, and decides what buttons to press every frame or every couple frames. And that's on the right side of the screen. You can see which buttons it's deciding to press.
Are they random at first?
Yeah. So the way it works is you start off with basically an empty brain. There's nothing in the brain except for maybe a couple connections, a couple neurons. And most of the time what that's going to do is just sit there. It's not going to do anything.
It doesn't even move at all.
It just moves. It doesn't know anything about the game, doesn't know what the buttons do, it doesn't know what the screen what's on the screen, what that means. You know, it's never seen anything like that. It's got no information.
But you're giving it a goal, right?
Yeah, so it starts off by kind of randomly trying a few very simple brains, and occasionally the brain has this instinct to go right, press the right button. That's what you're seeing here. And so it makes some progress in the level, and at the top left of the screen, there's this fitness score. And as it goes farther right, the fitness score goes up.
It's just like Brevwalker. So how many iterations did it have to go through?
So as it gets a higher score, it sort of breeds the better neural networks together, and that's where the evolution comes in. And so then they have children. I'm not going to explain how that works. No, but they have children, and then you get another generation, and so from generation to generation, you're breeding the best networks together, and you're getting better networks.
So
that way.
So each neuron is trying to achieve something: object avoidance,
neuron. It's kind of hard to interpret, actually. Neural networks don't have this really good interpretability. It's not like with code where you can say this line of code does this.
Right.
Any given neuron can have a bunch of different functions.
Okay.
But to answer your question, this graph shows you it took 34 generations. You know, you try a bunch of neural networks,
breathe them together, get a new
generation of neural networks. But it takes quite a while to simulate, because you have to simulate each brain in the level, and so there's like 200 brains per generation, and so it took like 24 hours to get a result where it could finally beat the level.
But that's only because it can breed so fast. If it was humans, it'd be 750 years, right?
Right, right. It would take a lot longer. And that's the thing is it evolution has had billions of years to produce these complex human brains,
right.
And Whereas this brain here, I looked it up just now, a jellyfish has something like 5,600 neurons. This thing, you can see, has like 10 neurons, right? It's a very basic brain. So in order to get the more complicated behavior, you need a lot longer.
What technology are you using? Is this TensorFlow or something?
So TensorFlow is great. And we're going to get to that with my next project. But this one, I actually just wrote all myself in Lua.
Wow.
I use Lua because that's sort of the scripting language that you can use in emulators.
Right.
It lets you get access to the screen and the controllers.
Right.
And so I just wrote all this code myself, and it was sort of an experiment to learn about evolutionary programming, which I've never done before this project.
What a great experiment, though.
Let me ask about your programming process here, though, because how do you get tempted to change the code to fix an error that keeps happening?
No, that's not allowed.
I know. Or do you just let it try to evolve?
Well, you can change the code, but it's very difficult to target a specific...
You don't know what's going on in there, do you?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, if it's, you know, getting stuck in one place, it's a little bit hard to say what changes you can make to the whole evolutionary process as a whole in order to actually let it learn how to get past that point. You don't want to just, like, go in and edit one connection because... Honestly, I don't know what connections I would have to edit to make
It will change all the other connections.
It's a black box.
Well.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's a black box. That's exactly right. So, but there are some general principles you can use to say, and there's a lot of study about this sort of thing too. And this implementation was based on a paper by Kenneth Stanley. And so a lot of it was just kind of implementing what he did in the context of Super Mario World. And just tuning all the parameters, all the little tweaks you can make. There's a bunch of numbers you can change to change how the evolution proceeds and how many neurons things get and how many species you have, that sort of stuff. And so most of it was just based on existing research. And there's a lot of research in the area that can really help out.
Let me ask this. Will it keep its knowledge into the next level? Or are all these neurons forming for this particular level and it has to repeat the process every time it receives a new field?
Yeah, for Mario, I trained the neurons on a single level. And so it only learns how to beat that one level. Now, the thing is, I actually did try to you take a brain that's sort of evolved to beat a certain level and you try it on another level and... It usually won't beat that level, but I actually have seen it in the case of simple levels. I actually have seen it beat another level with a brain that wasn't trained for that level. So it does learn things that are sort of more general than what it was trained to learn. And that's sort of the power of neural networks is they can – it's called generalization. They can generalize to a bunch of different situations that they've never seen before.
So it can learn pattern recognition. It's not just rote.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, and this is how Google beat the world champion at Go, basically. The AlphaGo was taught to play Go, not by humans. That's how Deep Blue worked. Humans started to play chess. AlphaGo just played a lot of games at Go.
Actually, AlphaGo did have some human input. It studied professional games, and that was sort of the starting place for its learning.
Okay.
And then from there, it played a lot of games against itself. Now, Google does have a new project called AlphaGo Zero, which does not learn at all from humans, and that project is actually done better. It actually crushes the original version of AlphaGo.
Humans screw it all up. Yeah,
humans do screw it all up. Yeah. It's able to learn novel strategies, things humans would never really think of.
So this is an interesting part of artificial intelligence where we try to model artificial intelligence and learning. Kind of, we try to guess how a human learns and try to apply it to computer programming. Yeah. It seems like this works, but does it seem like the best way to go about solving these problems?
Well, people used to think that you could, if you had enough rules, you had enough facts in a machine, that it could do what humans do. It could make judgments like humans make. And really, in the past few years, we've really seen that that's not true.
Right.
The best way to do it is to have a computer learn from examples or learn from its own exploration in much the same way that a human would learn. And I mean, if humans did it that way, then that's probably the best way for computers. But I think we've gotten some extremely good results where computers are starting to do better than humans at tasks that we never thought that computers would be able to do at all. Things like computer vision and playing games. Speech synthesis is now done with neural networks. It's generating voices. And there's all kinds of tasks where neural networks are doing better than humans.
So you've moved on from Mar.io to Maraflow.
Yeah.
Tell us about the new project.
So Maraflow is a totally different kind of learning. It doesn't try and learn on its own. In fact, it can't learn on its own because its entire goal is to try and predict what a human would act like in any given situation and do that, act like that. And so
that sounds almost impossible.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, if you can scroll to the beginning of this video, I have an example where three of the screens are Maraflow and one of the screens is my dad. And so viewers at home, and maybe you guys can try and guess which one you think is my dad and which one is the neural network.
I think upper right is your dad.
You think upper right is my dad?
Because he keeps jumping. He keeps hopping.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you'd be wrong.
Because number three is not your dad. It's stupid.
Wow, my dad's going to be...
He keeps driving. Actually, no computer would drive into the wall like that. That's a dead giveaway, right? That's the human going, I can't figure this out.
So the goal is for it to play like a human. I think my
you
my
fooled
dad's,
me.
He's still learning. He's still learning.
You fooled me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. Using the same techniques for this then?
It's a totally different approach. That's right. So you can imagine. Say I showed you a video feed. In fact, you can look at what's going on here. Say I showed you a video feed and asked you, and it just froze it, paused it, and said, what do you think the human is going to press on the next frame? What do you think the human, which controller buttons do you think the human's going to press? Here, if you're looking at this freeze frame, you might think, well, they're not going to press left or right, just straightforward, because that's where the road goes. And so the neural network looks at a sequence of frames and then tries to predict what the human's going to press in the next frame. And then it gets that frame and it tries to predict what the human will do in the next frame after that. And so it's always predicting what the human's going to do.
And it could do that pretty well.
It could do it pretty well, yeah. And then when it wants to play on its own, what you do is you take the human out of the loop. You have it predict what the first
frame
do? Of the controller are.
Wow.
What would the human do at the very beginning? And then you feed that back into itself and say, well, now what do you
like
think
that.
The human will do?
See, I've still got a little bit of disconnect because obviously it's not just a decision tree. This is far more complicated than
right.
a decision tree. But what is it exactly? What is it learning? So I know it's queuing on the artifacts it sees on the screen.
Yeah.
But when you say it's learning from the human, what is it learning?
On screen, you can see a picture of the inputs. That's the very top, and then it. You don't need to pause. It'll keep going. And from that, it sort of gets a bunch of neurons. It has a bunch of neurons, which it decides what each neuron sort of thinks at that moment. And then it goes on. There's actually a bunch of layers, and so it goes through a bunch of layers of these simple math problems, and it outputs a controller, a set of controller inputs. And so it's predicting controller inputs by this. And they're very simple mathematical rules, but there's a lot of math going on. There's tens of thousands of mathematical operations going on that takes the input screen and outputs some controller presses. And then once it makes those predictions, it trains against a bunch of data that I've recorded. So I've recorded the screen and I've recorded what my button presses are. And so it can take the screen, make predictions about what buttons it thinks I'm going to press, and then compare that to what buttons I actually did press. And when it makes an error in the prediction, then it sort of makes these small tweaks to that mathematical process that gave rise to the predictions.
Right.
And those small tweaks make it more likely to make correct predictions.
So each successive generation will be more correct.
That's right. Yeah. It'll lower the error rate in making those predictions.
Wow.
And over time, if you give it enough training data, it'll be able to do that in a wide variety of situations, and it'll have really low error in making those predictions.
This
it's
is
a lot
just,
to take in.
Yeah, but it's so interesting and so cool. And one of the things, so evolution happened because there was billions of years.
Yeah, external pressures,
and
right.
It could just go on and on. There was an immense amount of time. Computers can do this because they can do this so fast.
They can just reiterate over and over. Yeah,
and they can iterate so fast that you're thinking in a tiny, tiny chunk, But if it does it many, many, many times, it can actually simulate learning. Or is it really learning?
This is it is learning. It is learning. It's it is different from the way humans learn, though. There's no metaphor for evolution with Mariflow or with this type of recurrent neural network. Gradient descent is what they call it. A learning. This is a mathematical optimization problem. It's like you take this really high dimensional curve which represents error, and you try and find the lowest point on this curve. And so if you can minimize the error in this curve, then you can minimize the errors that it'll make in predictions. And so it's a very different form of learning from what humans do. It has some of the same results, though, but it does definitely behave differently from the way a human learns.
But you learned, didn't you?
I learned a lot from this project.
Yeah, I've learned
a lot from all these projects. I've got a lot more learning I want to do too. I'm not done with all this.
Well, tell us about that. What's next? So you've got this. You've got Mariflow. What's next on your neural learning horizons?
Okay, so Mario learns. It was a type of reinforcement learning. It learns just from its own gameplay how to improve its performance, right? And that's called reinforcement learning. But it did it by evolutionary algorithms. It learned through genetic breeding and evaluating rewards over time. What I want to do next is something more similar to what Google has done with AlphaGo or what DeepMind's done with some of their Atari learning, where they've learned to how to play Atari games really well. It's called Q learning, and I'm actually working on this project right now. I'm starting to get pretty good results. In fact, I just bought a new computer with a 1080 Ti just so that I could train my neural network faster. And it's going like two or three times as fast, which is pretty cool.
So you use the GPU to do this.
Yeah. GPUs are extremely important for neural network training. They can do a lot of operations in parallel, which is exactly what a neural network and a real human brain
do.
So GPUs are great. There's this new thing that Google is starting to build called TPUs. It's called a tensor processing unit. It's even better at doing these massively parallel computations.
And they're online. But they don't sell those,
so you can't buy those.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we need to get NVIDIA to give you some time on their huge GPU clusters.
They have GPU clusters.
Oh, my goodness. They're incredible. Oh,
that's cool.
Yeah. So my new project is using this new deep Q learning. It's not a new technique, but in the past few years, it's shown some really good results, and people have started to figure out how to really apply it. So, again, I'm applying it to Mario Kart. And I'm having it learn on its own. It's getting to a pretty good place. I'll probably be making a video about that fairly soon. But after just overnight training, not even 24 hours, just like 8 hours, because I have the 1080 Ti, it'll actually be able to win some races. And it finishes most of the races, which is not something you can always say about something that's learning on its own. But
so are you working in an AI now? Have you turned this into your career, or is this still just kind of a... personal project.
What is the career of a YouTuber?
Interesting. So are you going to make YouTube a full-time job?
YouTube's been my full-time job for the past 5.5 years. Ever since I was working at Microsoft, I quit to do YouTube full-time. Originally, I was making more or less just Minecraft videos, but they were very technical Minecraft videos. But I've sort of branched out into speedrunning, various other very technical endeavors. I love taking video games and seeing just how you can approach them from a very technical standpoint.
Look at these Minecrafts. Oh my God, this is amazing.
What you're seeing on screen, this is an Atari emulator that I wrote in Minecraft.
Yeah, I figured that out right away. Wow. Look at that. He's emulating an Atari in here, folks.
It's slow, though, because you're building an emulator inside of a game that's built in Java, that's running on a virtual machine, running on Windows. It renders at one frame every 4 minutes.
Look, I played this. You could play Donkey Kong. Cool. I have played this. I was so impressed. 1.9 million subscribers. I guess you could make a living.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
that's pretty good. That's really nice.
This is incredible work. Thank you very much, Seth.
We're thrilled to meet you. And anything you want to talk about, anytime you want to talk about your next project, let us know.
Sounds great.
I think this is so much fun. You said you're going to use TensorFlow next time.
Actually, Mariflow, it's named after
TensorFlow. Oh, it's TensorFlow. Oh, cool.
Mariflow uses TensorFlow. My new project, which I'm going to call MariQ, because it uses Q learning, and also because IQ, you know. It's a, anyway, that also uses TensorFlow. TensorFlow has really TensorFlow and a few other machine learning libraries have really enabled sort of the enthusiasts, the amateur enthusiasts, to really get in on machine learning, and it's made it a lot easier. So TensorFlow is great, PyTorch, there's a few others out there, but it's making it pretty easy for just amateurs to get in on it, with, you know, if they do a bit of reading and understanding about how this stuff works.
Use OBS for doing your videos?
I use XSplit for streaming, XSplit. And yeah, usually for making the videos, although I also do use like DxTory to record.
I'm asking for a friend. So it looks like your most viewed video, 1.8 million views, is SNES code injection.
That's not my most viewed video.
What's your most viewed video?
My most viewed video is a Minecraft animation. It's called Bite-Sized Minecraft.
Wow.
It's sort of a more of a set of comedy sketches.
That one's not as
interesting to the to the geeky.
I was encouraged that a video on code injection got almost 2 million views.
I thought
that's a really good sign. YouTube's not just for crotch shots
12
anymore.
Million is most
12 million. When you say the word Minecraft, you get automatically 6 million.
It helps. Yeah. I mean, Super Mario World's like a 20-something-year-old game at this point, 25, 27. Yeah. So I've done a bunch of work with Super Mario World. I've actually learned how to program for Super Nintendo so I could do all this work.
Wow.
And
so you actually made Flappy Bird in Super Mario World.
That's right, yeah. And
it's like a turducken of video games.
There's a turchickducken. Like, there's even deeper... I've actually done a jailbreak for Super Mario World. So the jailbreak, it permanently sits on the cartridge. There's a bit of RAM. There's 2 kilobytes of RAM in the Super Mario World cartridge. It's battery-backed, so that's what stores the save files. But if you put the right data there, when you try and load up a save file, it'll trigger whatever code that you want that's stored in that battery-backed RAM. And so you can have this persistent hack stored
into
the cartridge. It's a jailbreak. What I've written is a jailbreak that includes a hex editor where you can view and edit any memory on the console while you're playing the game. And so you can like change your power up, give yourself a cape, or even invalid power up states. But it also includes a mod loader. So you can write in bytecode, in hex, you can write in a mod and load in a mod for your Super Mario World on a real cartridge with a normal real Super Nintendo. There's no like modified hardware. It's just bits being stored in the cartridge.
This might be too much to ask, but can you do this on the SNES Classic?
I haven't tried yet. I did do it on the Wii U Virtual Console, and I assume
I guess if they're going to emulate it, they got to emulate
not?
It.
Let's
right?
go.
They
yeah.
And I think the Virtual or the SNES Classic is a very related emulator. So that's actually one of the things that I plan on doing soon is installing this jailbreak on the SNES Classic.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a mod that you can see written by P4+2.
Look at that.
Where you can, it's a telekinesis mod. You can move enemies around and
Is it 6502 assembler? What is the chip?
I prefer 6502 is the NES. The 65816 is the SNES.
And you have to write it in 65816, right?
That's right. All the bytecode you see on there.
And you're not typing in hex codes for your assembly language.
He sees the matrix.
I assemble it on the computer and then I get a bunch of bytecode, which I can enter via the hex editor on the jailbreak on the Super Nintendo.
And I thought it was hard typing in basic games from Compute Magazine. What do I know? Hey, I am really impressed, Seth. What fun. Seth Bling, youtube.com/SethBling. Subscribe, follow him. He's up to some no good that is really good. I really
we like the no good.
Thank you, Seth. Great to talk to you. Wow, is that fun, huh? Coming up in just a bit, we got to get to them because they're sweating bullets here in these giant...
These costumes are kind of hot.
I'm sorry. I apologize. We're going to get right to you in just a second. You won't believe some of the stuff our next guest has created. Sean Thorson will join us in just a little bit. But first, a word from our sponsor. When I created my new podcast, where did I go to get the domain name? I went to Hover.com.
Oh, of course. There's only one
place. That's the only place to go to get your domain names. All of my domain names are registered there, and they're for a couple of reasons. First of all, no BS. You go to Hover.com. I knew I wanted to call Leo on the line, Lottl, and it suggested Lottl.fun. I thought, that's a domain name. Bing. And you buy it. It was like $12, and that's it. There's no upselling. There's no, do you want to make a website? Do you want us to do your email? Do you want us to do this? They get home. Who has domain privacy is built in. They know you want that. So they don't even ask you. They just, it's part of the deal. Connecting it up to almost any site, just in many cases, one button push for WordPress and Squarespace and Blogger. It's very, very easy. They have 400 TLDs. I mean, you could be just not just .com, .net, but you could be .design, .pizza, Father Robert .pizza.
I mean, that's pretty delicious.
That's the greatest name ever. By using that for your business, for instance, lets people know, you know, .design, I'm a graphic designer, you know? And there's all sorts of other great domain names. It's actually fun to go in there, .tech, .art, .yoga. Best-in-class customer support, no upsells. Their Connect feature means it's easy to set it up with your website builder. You can get personalized email. By the way, this is if you say I don't need a domain name, you do, at least for your email address. You should not be at yahoo.com, at gmail.com. You should be yourname.com, right? So get it, or .design or .pizza. Actually, my email at .pizza would be great. Go there right now. Sign up for it. There, if you do your own DNS, I do. Best DNS management system ever. I mean, it's great. It's very affordable. Start building your online brand today. Get started today. Go to Hover, Hover.com/twit. 10% off your first purchase as a thank you. And we thank you because, of course, then they know you saw it on the new screensavers. Hover.com/twit. All right. They're in their uniforms. Don't put the razor head on yet.
That I've been is a told tall head.
That's a very uncomfortable hat. So the razor guy is waiting to put on the. Here comes the giant razor blade to go on. Right now he's a headless razor. It's coming up in just a little bit, but first our holiday gift guides continue. It's time to look at VR games. You got the latest VR gear, Sam Moskovich. From Ars Technica, has a look at the games you have to have.
What's up, Twit fans? This is Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica, taking a break from my usual VR headsets to talk to you about the best games and experiences that came out in 2017 for VR. It's an interesting year to talk about VR because there weren't a bunch of exciting new pieces of hardware. We had some stuff from Windows Holographic, Windows Mixed Reality, that tried to lower the cost but didn't really push the technological perspective. What that really means, at least for someone like me, is that the VR experiences are starting to settle. A fewer gimmicks and more really good ideas. So it's a good time to talk about some of the best games of the year. Luna comes from the studio Phenomena, whose staffers have made critically acclaimed games like Katamari Damacy and Journey. Luna follows those beloved footsteps with a touching story that plays out like a VR storybook. I think of it like a good Pixar film. You can hand this to a kid, and they'll instantly appreciate the cute cartoony animals and also the simple figure puzzles out with your hands kind of controls. That being said, if you're a grown-up, you will get in really deep with the emotions, the story, and the puzzles as well. So it really cuts across all ages and play styles to deliver something unique and touching. To the Top does the seemingly unthinkable in delivering exciting VR parkour. That is also comfortable. You'll use your hands to crawl, bounce, and leap across giant obstacle courses, and you'll aim to get fast times to a finish line while also collecting hidden gems and other collectibles. It's as close as we currently have to VR Spider-Man. I love how the game instantly feels fast and thrilling, yet also has a bunch of surprising depth. Check it out. If you own a VR headset and love the Adult Swim series Rick and Morty, spend some schmeckles on Virtual Rickality. This bizarre puzzle game is by no means the ultimate VR experience, but it is fun, immersive, and it delivers almost 3 TV episodes worth of content, Rick and Morty humor, complete with the show's whole voice cast. While we're on the subject, Rick and Morty fans should also pick up a little game called Accounting. It's short, but it's wacky, and it's free. If you like one, you'll love the other. VR systems are flooded with shooting games as of late, especially standstill and shoot arcade style ones. But there's one I'd be crazy not to recommend. Doom VFR. You can guess what the F stands for. This slimmed-down version of the 2016 Doom reboot makes running, blasting, ripping, and tearing a total VR blast. It's also surprisingly comfortable in VR, which is good because this bloody demon-killing game is fast. As of this taping, I've only tested a preview version on a high-end PC, and I'm hoping it will run just as smoothly on PlayStation VR. But if you had told me 2 years ago that I would enjoy a Doom VR game and not get sick, I would have laughed at you. Now, I'm laughing in joy. To close out my list, I have a tie for best VR game of 2017, and these two games, polar opposites. The first is Gorn. This is a hilarious dive into visceral, over-the-top violence. The game feels like a combination of Russell Crowe and Gladiator and a Roadrunner versus Wile E. Coyote cartoon. You have to battle your way out of a Roman arena with bouncy hammers, wolverine claws, and every melee weapon in between used to eviscerate your opponents. Sound effects, cartoony dismemberment, and other fine-tuned touches make this a memorable jump into M for Mature VR territory. Also, out of all of the games in this list, I would call this the most fun to play with a group of friends who are hanging out on a couch nearby and begging for their turn in VR. Just make sure not to wave your hands anywhere near the TV set. As you're using these sort of melee implements of death, you will almost certainly get close to smacking your own TV screen. Full disclosure, I totally did that. My other top pick for 2017 is called Static. This is a must-play for anyone who loves puzzle games. Players are stuck in a bizarre testing facility, a little bit like Portal, but not a ripoff. And your hands are trapped in a variety of puzzle boxes in this institute. You'll have to figure out how to free your hands, because they're sort of mapped to a PlayStation 4 controller, the DualShock 4. So all of the different buttons and joysticks in real life correspond to something in virtual reality. And the trick is, every single puzzle box does different things with the buttons. So your next puzzle might have the joystick do something totally different than the first puzzle, and on and on. I've just never seen anything quite like this in any puzzle game, let alone VR, in terms of having to learn on the fly and find compelling solutions to mind-bending puzzles. This learn-as-you-go game is coupled with wonderful VR tricks, incredible atmosphere, and the coolest of all, I'd say, a robust two-player mode where a friend can join you by using a smartphone. This one has an even different set of puzzles. I'd say it's a good year where this list can be so big that I've had to leave off some pretty cool games. There's From Other Suns, which is on Oculus, Dino Frontier on PlayStation VR, and Heart of the Emberstone for Oculus and Vive. If you're new to VR, I would suggest go over to ArsTechnica.com, where you can read my articles about the best VR games and experiences of the past few years, including stories on documentaries and other weird experiments. And you can follow me at SamRed on Twitter for anything else in terms of games, VR, and other crazy tech culture stuff. Thanks again. Have a good 2018.
Thank you, SamRed. Always great to get Sam Mashkovich on our show. And I'm nauseous just watching.
That's the thing. I like it, but even just playing 2D games, I start to get a little dizzy after a while.
Hey, guess who's here? Sean Thorson's here. I'm really excited to have Sean on. Sean, you may remember this. He wrote this book last year from Make Magazine, Props and Costume Armor. Sean is at Thorson Associates Workshop, which is just up the road a piece. Great to see you, Sean. Thank you for joining us
today
and for bringing your great... I don't want to call them cosplayers. These are amazing costumes.
I make cosplay. This is several levels above.
Look at this. There's a Schick Hydro Razor. And by the way, if you watch carefully, his lubricating strips light up.
That's right.
Pretty nice. Did you do that on commission from Schick?
I did, yeah. It was created as part of their marketing campaign last year, and they decided they wanted to have it walking around at different events to be able to actually meet people.
That's
and
awesome.
Hand out swag, that sort of thing. And, of course, you can't bring pixels to Comic-Con, so the actual character itself, I was able to take all the bits and bytes and digital models that they used for the animation and then bring it into the real world using CNC carving, 3D printing. And then, of course, all those parts are fairly fragile, so they had to be molded and made into fiberglass and other composites and metal parts in order to make it more durable.
You did not study this in school.
No, of course not.
You just figured this all out.
Right.
So tell me, so you were in the Navy. What did you do in the Navy?
Well, I'm still 1 week and a month in the Navy. I'm a surface warfare officer. So while I was still on active duty, I was a division officer on a destroyer running a group of sailors in a particular,
So you were in a CNC environment? And,
my first job actually was responsible for the guys in the Combat Information Center.
Wow.
So the operations specialist. So if you remember the opening scene in Top Gun with all the blue lights and the radar screens,
that room on the destroyer
was mine.
Wow.
And then after that, I went into the engineering plant on my second ship, and then and I was an instructor at a schoolhouse in Rhode Island for a couple of years for the Navy, and then left active duty and transitioned to the Merchant Marine.
Oh, neat. So yeah. Do you ship out still?
No, I don't. I did that for a handful of years, and what would happen is I'd go out to sea for months at a time, and I'd get back, and I'd suddenly be flush with cash and have nothing but free time.
So, kind of like a movie star.
Oh, it was hilarious.
Yeah, so, yeah, in between movies.
I started doing really frivolous things. One year I chromed my car.
That's different.
The whole thing?
That's definitely different.
Just the outside.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just the outside.
But, I mean, I had a lot of fun with it. It was basically just like, all right, well, it's been blue for like 10 years. Now it'll be really shiny. I got to learn a little bit about, auto body materials and that sort of thing.
And the finickiness of chrome.
Oh, my goodness.
Chrome's tough to work with.
I can't tell you how much I hate chrome lately.
But you look at this chrome helmet. This is pretty cool,
I'm
right?
very proud of it.
Super easy, right? You don't have to do any prep.
Yeah,
you just drop it in the vat
and it's
good to go.
You pretty much pull the thing out of the mold and, rub some snot on it and it's good to go. this thing actually, every time I find myself doing something with a polished metal finish, it always ends up being, prep it, clear coat it,
right.
Double check, go back and repaint
it. Because there's always
it,
little imperfections. Yeah,
chrome shows off every little imperfection.
And if it's not already perfectly shiny, almost chrome, before you chrome it, then after you do, it's going to show up every flaw.
Yeah.
So, this is round four on this paint job, and I'm still seeing things I don't like about it, so I'll go back and redo it at some point in the shop this year.
So this, you taught yourself, are there resources to learn this?
There
stuff?
Are. Again, like I say, every year I'd come back, I'd have all kinds of extra cash to throw away. But I also started sometime typically in May or June to get ready for Halloween.
The old Halloween thing.
So at the time, what would happen more often than not is I'd sit down and I'd start looking at, okay, well, here's this character that I really like from this video game or this movie or whatever else. And I'd start looking to see if, A, does anybody sell this thing? Because it'll be a lot easier in every way if I can just have
Just get
it.
A model, you mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, if there's a
buy
a
the kit.
Purchasable costume out there.
What was your first costume?
When I was a kid, who knows? But
the first
thing that was on this kind of level, I had just left Japan. I was forward deployed for a couple of years. And when I moved back to the States, I was really excited about having my first real Halloween.
Yeah.
And the idea at the time was I wanted to be a stormtrooper from Star Wars.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So the deal is, back then, you could find garage makers that were building kits on their own and that sort of thing. The problem is, of course, I'm a little short for a stormtrooper. All these were rigged for, designed for someone who's 6 foot or thereabouts. Right. So I was going to spend, some four-figure number of dollars to buy a kit that I'd have to hack and slash and mod and turn into something that would fit me. So instead, I started poking around on the internet, which, was less useful at the time. But I found this really amazing website. It was called studiocreations.com.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys had all these amazing step-by-step tutorials for everything you could want to know for how to make Star Wars costumes.
Right.
So, how to build a vacuum-forming machine, how to sculpt, how to mold. All these things, very useful. And that was sort of the beginning of finding my way into things like the Replica Prop Forum, a bunch of other, forums that are out there for people to discuss, building and shaping.
Actually,
and
it's funny because Star Wars is very active. There's the 509th. There's all these
501st. Yeah,
501st. Yeah, the squadron. So there are a lot of people making stormtrooper.
There are.
Oddly enough, stormtrooper costumes.
So the deal for me was after the first year, when I did that costume, I ended up in a different state each year after that for the next 3 years.
Here's where we sent a camera out. This is your studio where Jerry's trying on.
Now, I have to ask about this because, I understand doing something like a pilot's outfit because that had to be an actual costume piece for Star Wars. But when you take something like the Hydro model or even Iron Man where it was mostly CG, how do you actually turn it into a costume? Because joints aren't where they're supposed to be.
It's made up.
Yeah.
There's always some challenge trying to figure out the rigging. If you've got something like some of the costumes that I've done work out to be ridiculously bigger.
You're good with that hammer. That's good.
That's the rest of this costume. A lot of the times it's a question of figuring out where you can put joints so that you can maintain mobility.
Right.
For something that's essentially person-shaped, it's not that hard to do. But once you start getting into things that are bigger and weirder, you have to start finding ways to make it so that, okay, if I can cheat and put the shoulders in a little bit the wrong place, keep the hip joints where the character's hip joints are, and then you can kind of get away with, adjusting where your knees are going to be in relation to characters' knees. You can use...
Well, like on the Fighting Iron Man costume, like which is fantastic. I love that piece. I can tell the shoulders are actually down below. But to maintain the view...
So when they did this character for the film, the first one was actually done practical to some extent, the first film.
Okay.
And so when they did it, what you don't realize is they actually made the thing, they give it these hero proportions. So instead of normal, person proportions, it's actually more like, seven or more heads tall.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, they've actually built in significant platform heals. And that's why if you really go back and look at some of the earlier versions of Iron Man in the first two movies, he's got kind of a bell-bottom flare to the bottom of the legs.
Right.
So the wearer's ankles are actually a good 6 inches up off the ground.
Wow.
And it gives the character that much more height as far as making the
I have no respect for Robert Downey Jr.
That could not have been easy to move around.
No, it's. I mean, this one's it's definitely a little on the uncomfortable side. But then, in order to make that still look sort of human and not just ridiculous weird
look at
arms.
That. Oh my God, that's awesome!
Oh my goodness.
What you end up with also is they build up the shoulders a little bit, and of course in order to have a person's head inside the helmet has to be bigger than a person's head.
Right.
So in order for the character to maintain sort of human proportions, you still have, bigger head means bigger shoulders, means bigger chest, means, whatever. And of course, tiny little waist.
We have a tiny little TIE fighter pilot over here. That is beautiful, too. I really like that.
In a bit of a rush to find someone to wear it this morning.
She's a little smaller than the normal size.
That's true.
Fighter.
Yeah,
but you got to get in that plane. That plane is not that cockpit.
No, it's
small.
Not. No, there's a lot of space in there.
Yeah. You got to be Tom Cruise size to get in that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, this one's actually intended for my girlfriend, who's a good 6 or 7 inches taller than my model here today. So she's a little stunted, but it works.
She doesn't look stunted. Hey, let's give them credit, because they've been standing around in these uncomfortable objects for a long time. Do you know your names of your various models here?
So I have Charlotte in a black TIE pilot.
Hi, Charlotte. And she's then, a Sea Scout.
Yep. Here in Petaluma. Same with Agatha, her sister, in the Iron Man costume.
That's a and woman then, in the Iron Man costume?
It is,
nice
yeah.
job,
and
Agatha.
Then,
you fooled
my
me.
My shop assistant, Freddy's wearing the
Hydra
Freddy. Bot today.
He looks like a giant razor.
It works.
You guys are great. Thank you for being very patient. You can go to the bathroom now.
It's
they,
true.
They really
They've been
great.
Locked in those.
So you can do this. You do this for fun, but now it's become a business for you.
Yeah, it's really a hobby that's just completely gotten out of control. It started off like
it's
I say.
You can
just,
support it
yeah,
though.
Well,
right?
What was happening was every year I'd go out, get excited about Halloween, start building a thing, and then the next thing you know, after a few years of pictures getting around and people sharing things all over online, it got to the point where people started asking me to build things for them instead.
You made this for Take. Who does it take to?
2K.
2K.
Yeah,
that's
2K
right.
Games. So this is actually the harpoon gun that's carried by one of the characters in their game Evolve. So the deal was they had this giant monster statue that they were taking around to all their different events so they could kind of promote the game.
Right.
And they were having a problem where people would walk by and kind of glance at it and not really, do much else. Like, hey, wow, that's really cool.
Nice model.
Maybe stare at it for a while, but then that was as much traction as it was really getting. So they decided to go ahead and set it up with all the different weapons from the game so that people could actually stand and pose for pictures hunting the giant monster. So I did 4 different weapons. There was this harpoon gun.
By the way, I'm glad you chose the 100K charging unit because that charging cell is so much better than
way.
It's. Yeah. 50K.
Well, actually, it was a lot of fun because they gave me the in-game, the digital assets that are used to render the thing in-game.
Okay.
And then all the skins so I could get really good up-close detailed pictures to look at for, all the warning labels and things like that.
And you
that.
Know what you do, Sean, that's so good? The distress.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
It
really
looks
ever do that.
Like it's been used. In movies, that makes a big difference.
Step one, it really helps to have a really filthy workshop.
So some of this filth
is
real.
Natural.
Yeah, most of it's just on account of it's been sitting still for too long. It's why in my case, I tend to prefer things that are distressed and used and thoroughly beaten up so that if there is a little scratch in the paint somewhere or a little bit of dust that gets in there
you don't
somewhere,
say, oh, there's something wrong with it. So this is, you make mold. Tell us how you're doing this.
So
this is
right
fiberglass?
Here, I'm actually demolding a urethane resin copy
of the
same goddess Thor helmet that's sitting here on the table. So what will happen in this case is I've made a silicone rubber jacket over the original digital sculpt that was CNC carved. And then once that's done, it's just a question of taking that silicone mold, coating the inside with resin, and then once it cures, you've got a shell that you can use to actually wear. Need some trimming and cleanup and that sort of thing.
You also work in fiberglass.
I'm doing a lot more fiberglass than I would really like.
Do you do any vacuum forming?
A little bit, yeah, here and there. It's, usually the way it works out is it's a budget concern. So my
fiberglass is cheaper and easier.
Yeah, well, no. The vac form parts are cheaper and easier. The fiberglass parts will last a lot longer. So if you've got, you know, a fiberglass piece that gets painted proper and, you know, treated like you care about it, I mean, you know, it's built
longer.
Like a boat.
Right.
Whereas if you've got a vac form thing that's built like the lid on your, you know, cafe coffee cup, you know, you're going to have an easy time finding things that'll tear or break or split or, you know, anything like that.
We actually went, we were lucky enough to get to go to your hyper secret location. And do a little a tour of it. And I thought we could just roll that in right here. This is Thorsen & Associates Workshop.
So right now it's kind of tough to see most of what's going on just because I'm buried under the last couple of months' worth of work. So what I have in this corner is where I tend to do all of the molding and casting type stuff. So you can see this huge stack of pink rubber molds for making things out of urethane resin. All these molds are silicone, and this is where I'm making, you know, little pieces that get added on to some of the bigger pieces. Moving further down this way, on this corner is usually where I make all of my molds. Again, we're in the middle of about 7 or 8 different projects in the room right now, so of course everything's piled with pieces and parts from other projects. So it's kind of a disaster, but usually this is where all of the splatter happens, where all those pink molds are being made. Once pieces actually come out of the molds, usually I take them to the back bench here, where all of the cast parts actually go through and get cleaned up. So this is where all the sanding and trimming and cutting ends up happening. So usually there's a lot of dust in this corner. But currently I'm in the middle of making a whole bunch of pieces, which is why you've got all these little orange fiberglass bits all over the place, which we're coating with a mold release so that we can make parts out of them. Moving a little further, I've got a pair of 3D printers here, both of which pretty much tend to run 24/7. So these are my Zortrax M200s. It's just a regular filament deposition modeling 3D printer. Nothing unusual about them in any way. But like I say, ever since I got these machines, I try to keep them going on something all the time. So there's a huge backlog of models that I've got sort of stored so that I can get around to it. And I don't want to have to sit and wait for something to print when I finally have time to mess with them. You know, keep these boxes on top so that they've always got kind of a constant temperature inside, and it keeps the dust out of the machinery. In this ridiculously cluttered little room, this is where my CNC machines live. I've actually got 4 of these Carverite CNC machines. They're made for woodworking, but most of the time when I'm doing the projects that I'm doing, I use these to carve out pieces to make, you know, helmets and armor parts and, you know, weapon replicas and that sort of thing. And then the current work in progress, this corner is where I'm building my paint booth. Right now, it's just where I'm stacking up all of the things that are waiting to be painted. So there's a lot of dust while I'm getting around to that mess. And then, of course, on the side, there's always the collection of combat garden gnomes in progress. I was working on a merchant ship. I was a navigator on a container ship and had a little bit of free time to kill and decided it'd be really funny to make garden gnomes when I got home. Since I have all these materials and tools and skills and everything else, I wanted to come up with something that would sort of pay for itself and possibly make some money. So I came up with a handful of different ideas for, you know, silly things to do with garden gnomes that nobody had done before. And out of the, I don't know, a dozen or so different things that I'd sort of, you know, brainstormed overnight, the only one that I wasn't able to find somebody already doing was a mashup between little green plastic army men and garden gnomes. So at this point, I've sculpted out 13 different poses. They've all been molded and cast, and every time I've got a couple of slow minutes in the shop, I'll go ahead and cast another one. And then when I've got 15 or 20 of them on the bench, I'll sit down, trim them all, paint them all, and list them on my Etsy shop. So it's the side thing that goes on pretty much constantly in between all of the more interesting, bigger projects.
Everybody needs to go out, run to your Etsy shop, and buy the attack gnomes. Yeah.
Well, they're actually horribly out of stock. Usually the way it works is every time I get a batch of them painted up and ready to go, the first thing that happens is they sell out in 2 minutes, and I get 30 emails from people saying, when do you have more?
I bet they do. Those are awesome.
Yeah,
did you study sculpting? I mean, how did you know how to sculpt?
No, I started with a lump of clay and took apart the parts I don't want and added the parts I needed and had a gnome.
You were saying your dad loved to play. What was that all about? We know the truth is out now. Okay. You were saying that your dad worked with his hands. He worked on cars.
Yeah, he's an auto mechanic by trade.
Yeah. So you must have inherited some of that
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's fun because most of the time he spent when I was growing up saying, learn how to do something else, go to school, get yourself a job where you can sit in an office with air conditioning, that sort of thing.
don't follow in my footsteps.
Yeah, a lot of that. And now I'm working with my hands, spending most
of my
time.
Does he love what you're doing now?
You know, it's funny because it took the longest time before, like after I quit my day job and started focusing on this stuff, there was a few years where pretty much everyone in my family kept asking, like, so when are you going back out to sea? you know, and it wasn't until I started actually, like, getting, you know, real exposure and a lot of people asking for things and, you know, big projects where it finally got to the point where they stopped saying, hey, so you're going to get a job again?
Now they know. Now they know. Yeah. How many, do you ever throw anything out? It looks like you've got everything you ever made in there.
No, it's not even close to everything I've ever made. Yeah.
And what is that, a giant tongue?
What is this one? This is a mold for a project that I was, I started a little bit, well, a few years ago. It's another Warhammer 40,000, like, Space Marine. This is the bigger,
like, shoulder
batter
piece?
That's actually the thigh.
Holy cow!
Yeah. So this suit, by the time it's fully rigged, you know, little Charlotte that's in my TIE pilot today, I've been doing all the test fitting with her wearing it. And
wait a minute, how tall is she going to be?
She's about 5'2" without it, and fully rigged in the suit, she's a little bit over 8 foot tall.
Oh, okay. I bet you can't wait to get in that, Charlotte. Talk about revenge.
How many drafts do you have to go through? Because, I mean, some of these look like wonderfully finished items. But, for example, take the helmet. That's probably not Master Chief, maybe Linder or Fred.
That's from Red versus Blue. This is Agent Washington.
Oh, okay,
it's
Washington.
Red versus Blue, that's what it is. So
a few years back, we were getting ready for Halloween, this big group of friends, and we were all talking about what do we do for next year. And a friend of mine, his wife, suggested we do the characters from Red versus Blue. The idea being, once you've made one, you put a mold, you just make as many
paint
copies
it a different
as you want,
color.
Paint them different colors, you've got the whole cast.
Yeah.
So this is, the first time around we made, I think it was 8 or 10 of them we all had walking around together downtown here for Halloween. But this guy here is essentially version 2, finally got to where I destroyed the original mold, just, you know, used it up.
Right. Can you see out of this?
You can, yeah. It's, it's mirror tint, just like...
May I put it on?
It's fine with me. It's blow the cobwebs out, I guess.
My ears are too big.
Oh, there you go. But yeah, it's, aside from a couple of cosmetic changes, it's essentially exactly the same as the first one.
Oh, you know, this is great.
I noticed some...
I love it. Right. You can see out of it.
You can see out of it.
Yeah.
This is actually... Can you do an entire show like that, Leo?
Sure. I love this. I think I'm going to have to because I don't think it's coming off.
I wish you'd have warned me. I could have brought the rest of the armor.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. I don't think it's coming off.
Uh-oh.
Well, anyway...
Is there a big project you want to work on?
The Michael Keaton Batmobile from 1989.
That's not going to fit in your workshop.
I don't need it to fit in my workshop. It'll become my daily driver so I can go for groceries and so on. I'm not worried about fitting it in the workshop.
That's amazing.
I love this.
You know, there's always tons of little weird things. Like, I've got a bucket list stack of, you know, things that are written up on
the wall. Has Hollywood come to call?
I've done a few pieces for films. The way I usually explain it to people is, you know, when I've done stuff for movies, it's either, you know, really big things for little movies that you probably never see, or it's really little things for big movies that you might never notice.
Ghostbusters,
yeah,
right?
Last year's Ghostbusters movie, when that came out, they needed a hood ornament for the new Ecto-1 car.
Uh-huh.
So a friend of mine was actually a concept artist for the film, and when they were talking about it at the last minute, like, hey, we should have done this, he says, you know, I know a guy that can pull that together.
Wow.
And so I get an early morning phone call saying, hey, can you give us a hood ornament in about a week? He did the design. You know, sent me the 3D model, and I basically did all the fabrication, chromed it, and got them sent out to him with about a week's notice.
You're an artist. You're an artist, man. This is my favorite.
Yeah.
Don't you love how this looks?
The stressing on that is absolutely
It's amazing.
Perfect.
So this one here was actually a reject casting out of the mold, but everything in Fallout is some sort of worn out and beat up and whatever.
Yeah,
so
it's perfect.
In this case,
it's rusty.
There was a big nasty blob where there was a bubble in the resin on one side, so I just kind of knocked the bubble off and made it a little bit more messed up.
Right.
So if you look really close, there's like a bullet ding right here.
I
put another one up here just so that it looks even more, you know, used. And then, you know, rusted the heck out of it.
You know, how do you rest it? Do you spray it?
So in this case, I started with a black wash to kind of take down. Originally, it was a bright silver metallic color. And after the black wash, it got a rust wash in a couple of different shades that, you know, were like burnt sienna and raw umber and that sort of thing. And then
beautiful.
The last thing was to put dabs of glue where I wanted the really heavy scale rust. And that was dusted over with
there.
Cinnamon.
That's
so actually cool.
Cinnamon? I thought it smelled rather good.
My guy Freddie, that was actually his idea for let's pack on some more rust. And you
it's
know,
the best tasting rust ever.
Well, you know, you spend enough time with your shop smelling like, you know, like paint and fiberglass fumes and everything else. It's nice for the one day where it becomes
not edible.
Sort of
cinnamon day
it's
in the
not
shop.
Edible.
It's not edible.
Well, it was actually one of these. I was asking him, I was like, you really figure this is going to work? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I don't want to pull this thing out of a box in a year and find out it's, you know, turned sour. Like, you know, I'm not using food products as finish. And he did some research. Turns out they use cinnamon as a preservative.
This is how makers do the cinnamon challenge.
Yeah, it's the way.
This is so fantastic. I want to thank your models for doing... Look at that. Look at that. What is that? Wow.
So that's another old build. We did the Space Marine, again, from a tabletop war game called Warhammer 40,000.
Oh, yes.
So this is the
smaller... But the problem with Warhammer, they're about 2 inches tall. These are big, full-sized,
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, scaling is entertaining. In that case, that was a sort of digital build. So I started off with the same models that were used to render the characters in a first-player shooter called Space Marine. And then those models were fed into a program called Pepikura that'll actually take, like, an OBJ file and unfold it and lay it all flat so that you can print it out on your inkjet printer. Then you take all those pieces, print it on cardstock, cut them out, and they're all tabbed and numbered so you can fold it all back together and make an actual physical object.
Sean, you have found...
Oh, I didn't invent the thing.
No, you found your place in the world. This is... You're a natural. This is amazing. You taught
all... Go forth and make.
Just incredible. And look at this. Iron Man... And what's the name of the TIE fighter pilot? Is
that's
there
it, TIE fighter pilot.
TIE fighter pilot.
And Razorhead.
And
the Schick Hydrobot.
The Schick Hydrobot, which is, by the way, there's more in progress because you're going to have them all over the country. There'll be Hydrobots
all over the
everywhere.
World. Yeah, they're going to. So there's the one that I made last year that's made, I don't know, at least.
Are you
half
working
a dozen
on the head so it's not so uncomfortable?
Oh, he'll be fine.
I am so impressed. Really, so impressed with your art. And it is art. I mean, this really is fantastic.
I can't take much in the way of credit for the design, but the actual fabrication and finish, that's us.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure Hollywood's going to continue to come calling. We're going to be seeing your works all over the place. Sean, it's really nice to meet you. Sean Thorson, Thorson & Associates Workshop. And there it is, protagonistforhire.blogspot.com if you want to see more about how he does it. And what's the name of your Etsy shop? I know you don't have any gnomes right now.
It's Thorsoli, Thorsoli.
Thorsoli. Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you expect to make more of those gnomes?
It happens, yeah. Yeah, every time I sit down and I've got nothing going for a minute, I make another dozen or so. And
as we all do.
Just crank out some gnomes, will you? Yeah. Very nice. Sean, I really appreciate you bringing everything in. Very, very nice to meet you. And thank you again to your fabulous models who've been wearing these for way, way too long. But they really look good. I mean, there's really... Is it kind of fun to be Iron Man and just kind of... Like, nobody wants to mess with you, right? Iron Woman, Schick Hydro, TIE Fighter Pilot. Y'all look great. Thank you. Thank you, Sean Thorson. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to do a call for help, and we will also compare the cameras in the top-of-the-line smartphones. But first, a word from our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. I know there's a few of you are thinking, I'm going to mortgage the house and set up a shop and build these things. You could do that. You could refinance. You can get some cash out of your house at Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage is from Quicken Loans, the number one lender in the country, at least in my heart, and in the words of J.D. Power, number one in customer satisfaction, not just this year and last year and the year after, but for 8 consecutive years for the loan approval process, 4 consecutive years, including this year, for mortgage servicing. So they're a great company to work with. Quicken Loans has really kind of, you know, turned around the loan business. They've decided that they needed a technological revolution in the loan approval process. And they have put this, you don't have to go to a bank anymore. You don't have to go to the attic to get paperwork. You can do it all on your smartphone. And it doesn't take weeks or days to get a home loan. It takes minutes. You can do it at an open house. You answer a few simple questions. They have trusted partnerships with all the financial institutions so they can get everything they need with your permission very quickly. And then based on your income, your assets, your credit, they'll show you the mortgage loans that you qualify for. You pick the down payment, the term, the rate, and you're done. It in literally within a couple of minutes, you're going to get approved for a home loan that's perfect for you. You'll apply simply, you'll understand the process fully, and you will mortgage with confidence at Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Go to rocketmortgage.com/NSS. I know maybe you're not buying a house right this minute. Bookmark it. That way you'll know when the time comes. rocketmortgage.com/NSS. You're ready to get that loan approval in minutes. You could literally do it at an open house. They're an equal housing lender, of course, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. From Quicken Loans, rocketmortgage.com/NSS. Whether you're buying a new home or refinancing your old home, rocketmortgage.com/NSS. We thank them so much for their support of the new Screensavers show. All right, I've been waiting for this. I'm really glad Jason Howell has done it. We've got a call for help coming up. But Jason compared all the big cameras in all the big phones to figure out which is the best. Here you go. This is what you've been waiting for, our camera phone showdown.
Everyone has priorities when it comes to smartphone features. Some phones are perfect for the battery obsessed. Some phones are ideal for mobile gaming aficionados. But which phone produces the best bokeh or bokeh shots? You know what I'm talking about. Those shots that resemble what you get from a DSLR, where the foreground is in focus and the background is blurred. Yeah, that feature. Well, I have five phones that are capable of these types of shots. We've got the iPhone 8 Plus and the iPhone 10, the Samsung Galaxy Note 8, the OnePlus 5T. All those four phones have dual cameras on the back to make it happen. And then there's the Google Pixel 2 XL that uses its trusty artificial intelligence to calculate and produce the effect using a single camera. I put them all through their faces. See what I did there? So let's see how these phones compare by starting with some human subjects. First, we have Megan Maroney standing outside, and most phones got this shot pretty right in regards to background blur. The Pixel 2 XL does get a bit uneven, which is pretty common on this particular phone, considering its blur is entirely done with AI. All phones showed an in-focus sidewalk peeking between Megan's arm and side, and that right there is a big challenge for this kind of processing. Then we have Anthony Nielsen, producer of the new Screensavers. He's in our studio here checking his phone, as he does a lot. And I must say that all phones perform this shot pretty well. The iPhone X would be my pick for best here, but even the mid-tier OnePlus 5T handled this shot pretty accurately. Could be the solid lighting, could be luck, but I consider this shot a win for all devices in this roundup. This is Burke in his natural habitat, where he's often found wearing a motorcycle helmet. Translucent parts of the helmet can be a challenge, and none of the phones seem to do a perfect job around the edges of that visor. Each one has a hard time determining the edge of the visor and the background behind it, and this is very apparent along that bottom edge in front of Burke's eyes. And speaking of translucency, transparency, this shot here of a glass filled with ice cubes and water on a table is another tricky situation. Pretty much every phone struggled on this at the top edge of the glass, where it ultimately ends up looking kind of like a blurry mush. Every phone, that is, except for the Google Pixel 2 XL, which nailed it, but my eyes can't unsee that the right edge of the table is in focus while the left edge of the table is totally blurred. No, thank you. And finally, this statue of Luke Skywalker placed in the same studio environment. The iPhone X and iPhone 8 both look pretty good, minus a few small spots of misplaced blur in the hair that you see there. The Pixel 2 XL looks pretty good here too, but I had a very hard time getting the camera to recognize the subject when trying to take a picture. It took me 3 or 4 shots to get it to process the blur you see. So if you've been keeping track, no portrait mode in this roundup comes out unscathed. The ones I'm usually most impressed with on social media seem to come from the iPhone 8 Plus and the iPhone 10, but even those phones were challenged here. The Pixel 2 XL does a pretty good job considering it's all based on software and no extra hardware. The Samsung Galaxy Note 8 can be hit or miss, but honestly, that camera is capable of some pretty awesome shots all around. And the OnePlus 5T, well, let's consider it a nice bonus that it has this feature, maybe not the one to use if this is your top priority. And that's not even taking into consideration the fact that some of these phones, the iPhone X has extra hardware on the front-facing camera. Also, the Google Pixel 2 XL can do front-facing portrait mode shots. We're going to save those maybe for another shootout. I'm Jason Howell, and you can catch me on All About Android and Tech News Weekly here on twit.tv.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't use the portrait mode very much on any of those cameras because it always looks a little processed somewhere or another.
Well, because you shoot with an actual real camera.
Yeah, just get a good camera and do the same thing. Well, right.
The funny thing is they're all basically using the same hardware, the same sensors.
It's roughly the same Sony sensor.
Roughly the same, but the software and how much attention they put into it, that really makes all the difference.
It did kind of confirm what I've thought all along, which is if you had to pick among those equals, and they're all very good, I like the Pixel 2 XL.
Pixel 2 XL is pretty good.
Yeah.
I think he was dead on with the 5T. The 5T may have the hardware. The software's just not there. He wanted to put the Essential in there, but I told him, no, it's
not even close.
It's not even close.
Although, I don't know if you've got it yet, but Essential has released new camera software.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. And apparently they're getting better. So I would take a look at what Essential's doing with their camera software. I always liked the black and white mode, but you're right.
Right.
It felt a little soft. Didn't feel like there was as much detail in there as some of the flagship phones. Of course, it's about $400 now if you shop around for that Essential phone. Thank you, Jason Howell. You can see more of Jason on All About Android every Tuesday evening right here on the Twit Network. And, of course, every Thursday it's Tech News Weekly with the big newsmakers and newsbreakers of the week. All right, are you ready? It's time for a call for help.
Let's dig in.
Here's Tom from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hey, Leo and Father Robert. I recently graduated from a full-stack web developer program here in Cleveland, and I used my MSI GP60 to get me through. It's a bit of an older laptop, so I'm looking to make an upgrade and was curious about what recommendations you two might have. Requirement-wise, I need to be able to use Photoshop and Illustrator, support a text editor, and I would like a laptop with a good keyboard. Up here in Cleveland, there's a lot of C# .NET jobs, so I'm leaning towards sticking with PC, but would be open to switching to a Mac. Any help you can provide would be greatly appreciated. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
This is a classic question. Which computer do I buy?
And we're going to fight it out because we have different opinions and all of that. He mentioned two, which we should probably start with, the Dell XPS 13.
Right. Which is good.
And the HP Spectre.
Those are fantastic.
I have the original Spectre 13T. That was the pretty brown one with the copper hinges. Right. And they've got white ones now with silver hinges. Those are really nice computers.
Yeah, and the new one, the one that they had just released, the Spectre 360, the latest generation, that is a fantastic computer. It's light. It lasts a long time. i7, lots of storage, great screen. It's convertible. And if you get the educational discount, you can knock between $300 and $500 off the price. So that's actually not bad either.
But he did say keyboard was important.
Yeah.
If you're coding, you're doing a lot of typing. And for those, I have to say, I really like the ThinkPad. And you can spend thousands on a ThinkPad. I think my X1 Yoga was almost $3,000. But this ThinkPad, this is the one I probably would recommend, is the T470S. This is a pretty high-end system, one of the best keyboards on the market. And I think I paid $1,300 for an i7 plus 12 gigs of RAM. This would be a great little coding machine. The T470 starts at $799. And I'm running Visual Studio Code on here, which is probably one of the things you're going to use. If you're using, if you're writing .NET programs, you're probably going to use Visual Studio. So I agree. If you're going to stay with .NET, Linux, you can do it with Linux. Mono's available on Linux, and I think that there are really a lot of .NET coders on Linux. But, Windows is kind of where .NET belongs.
Right.
So the beauty of all of the three we've mentioned, the Dell XPS 13 or 15 if you want more screen real estate, this 14-inch ThinkPad T470S, and the 13-inch HP Spectre, the beauty of all three of those is they run in Linux great. So they're going to come with Windows 10. But you're not going to have any trouble taking a modern Linux, Ubuntu. I use Entergos, which is a version of Arch, and putting it on there. I found that even the 13T, which I thought I was never going to get anything installed on that HP Spectre, worked just fine. You have to turn off secure boot because that's you need an assigned operating system. Linux is not in most cases, but you can still use UEFI, and it runs beautifully. So on the Spectre, I think the Spectre is great if you want thin and light.
Right,
it is gorgeous. Battery life, average.
It's definitely not the highest of all Ultrabooks, right. But I mean, it doesn't sound like he's going to be super portable. He just needs something that he can move from place to place.
This T470, they still work with the Lenovo dock. They're making a new dock for next year, but I love that because this has built in all of the ports you could ever desire, including full size HDMI and Ethernet, and then you just leave that on your desk. When you get home from taking your laptop out to the coffee shop, because I know if you're a coder, you spend a lot of time in the coffee shop, you just dock it. It's automatically hooked up to it. The other thing I like about the T470, dual cell batteries mean you're pushing 11 hours battery life on here if you get both batteries. And these are very upgradable. You can work on these very easily. Simple Phillips screwdriver to open it up. You can replace almost every component in here. You can add additional drives or increase drive capacity very easily. Shop around. You'll find some good discounts on ThinkPad hardware,
right?
Including the business discounts if you can find the code. Hint, hint. That's why I was able to get a 30% discount on this.
That's not bad.
And that made it very affordable. Now, he's a student, right? So that's the other thing.
You can get a student discount. Now, I used to be really big into docks, especially when I had my Dell series notebooks. But USB-C has kind of gotten rid of that because you can get a very competent dock that is literally just one connection.
Right.
For power, for networking, for display, for everything. Now, I would not recommend this anymore. This used to be my standby. This is my Acer S7.
The S7's great, and they have a replacement.
5 years now?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah.
But the one that is the replacement for this is either the Swift 7 or the Spin 7. And the Spin 7 was something I
would
recommend.
That's a two-in-one, right?
It's a two-in-one. It's a convertible. It's an i7, 8 gigabytes of memory, 256 or 512 gigabytes of PCI-connected SSD. The keyboard is actually quite good. Even on the S7, a little soft. This has a little click to it. And some travel, ultralight, 12 hours of battery life, and this of all the notebooks we've mentioned, this would be the low price option. This would be sub $900.
Yeah,
you've got so many options right now, and unlike the S7, the Swift 7 installs Linux very well.
Yeah, that, I think as a programmer, that's always going to be something that you want to keep in mind. Even a dual boot machine,
yeah.
Because many great programming tools run on Linux. If you're going to use Visual Studio, having Windows there as well is a great thing. I think everything we've mentioned is a good choice. I don't think anything's wrong. The best thing to do, if you could, try the keyboards.
That's the massive.
Some of these really thin and lights, like the HP, the Acer, just don't have a lot of travel. And while they're better than Mac, and by the way, notice we didn't mention two companies. Apple and Macintosh, way overpriced now, and I think in many ways Apple has really abandoned its pro audience. Those keyboards are, I think, unusable.
They've gotten to the membrane keyboard. They just squish. They're squishy.
I don't like the touch bar. I don't think they're great for programming. Mac OS is great for programming. Unfortunately, the new Mac laptops are not. If you're going to buy a Mac laptop, you're going to probably want to look at the 15-inch without the touch bar.
Right.
They haven't updated that in 3 years, 4 years. They still sell it, though, so... You could go there. Maybe wait till next year. Apple probably will announce it early 2018 new MacBooks. We also didn't mention Microsoft. Their Surface laptop, their Surface Book, or their
a little pricey, but they are very well made.
They're well made, but I think we've seen problems with all of them.
Yeah.
I think this is a new business for Microsoft. They're not. I know you might say, "Oh, haven't they made?" No, they haven't made laptops before. I'm not as big a fan of the Surface.
The Surface Book,
the Surface Laptop, or the what do they call the tablet one with that weird keyboard? Don't get that.
Oh yeah, yeah. The Surface Book was an interesting idea. Way too expensive for the hardware that it delivered. Nice design, but even Megan Maroney, who's got your
she
Surface
has my,
Book,
my first generation
she
Surface Book.
She doesn't like
She's
to
not
use
crazy
it.
About
just
it.
Doesn't
yeah.
feel
yeah.
right.
Yeah, I am gonna. All of the ones you mentioned are fine.
Yep.
I'm gonna say get ThinkPad. And I'm going to even go out on the limb and say more programmers use ThinkPads than any other kind of computer. I have no evidence to back that up. I just believe it. I really think that's true. This is the programmer's computer, mainly because a great keyboard
right.
makes a great experience.
And you know, I can back that. I think the ThinkPad is actually a very, very good computer. I will say, though, the reason why I like the Acer Spin 7 is because it's carbon neutral. 100%. It actually sucks CO2 out of the atmosphere. I have no evidence to support that, but that's what I believe.
Sorry. There you go. Our evidence-based assessment of the right computer for you. Tom, we really appreciate the call. It's a great question. And I think that the good news is, and this is why I feel like Apple may be in a little bit of trouble, even Microsoft, yeah. is that the Windows ecosystem is so rich. There's so many manufacturers and so many different ways to go. No matter what your interest, better battery life, better screen, mm-hmm. better keyboard, you can find something that'll fit your needs. Yeah. You're actually in a pretty good shape. And do check with the school that you're going to for discounts.
Your school discounts are fantastic in between semesters. So you're now in between a semester, you might be able to get
it's
a great
deal. It's a
good
deal. Time, yeah. Yeah. So it's been great having you on the show. But guess what? Next week, Patrick Norton makes his triumphant return. If you've got a question for Pat, here's how you ask it.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
I would like to see some research. I'm willing to bet that I'm not wrong that more programmers use ThinkPad.
It's a very
at least
popular
in the
choice.
Windows space. A lot. Of, I mean, most of the programmers I know are still using Macs. Yeah. Frankly, that's a very popular choice. But it is the high price spread.
And I'm sure someone must have done a study somewhere that we can find.
I'll check yeah. Reddit. Probably the ThinkPad subreddit will have all the information I need. Now, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, it is time for the mailbag.
This is the first time we've gotten the mailbag on this side of the studio, Leo.
I like what this. Happened. The chairs break over there? Oh, the fireplace is way too hot.
Yeah.
We've been we turned it up to make Iron Man crazy. Actually, they're still standing there. We're just going to leave them there for this. I have email one, if you don't mind.
Yes, please.
I'll start off. Hi, screensavers.
Hey.
Is there a way to block data being sent from my PC out to a website? I go to a website that deals with World War I land ships, and one of the members there noticed that his PC was being used to send out data to CoinHive. What?
Wow.
Oh, we know all about that.
Yeah.
If this is in the webpage script, how do I prevent it from using my PC to send data out? Ned from Los Angeles is worse than that, Ned. Mm-hmm. So CoinHive is one of several ways that a website can make a little bit of money by using a little bit of your CPU
so
to mine,
bad.
Well, it's not Bitcoin, but something like
Ethereum.
Bitcoin. Ethereum, yeah. A cryptocurrency. This is a trend.
I hate this. This is horrible.
I'm not.
Horrible,
well, Steve Gibbs and I talked about this a few weeks ago. It's very easy to prevent, by the way. In fact, if you use an ad blocker or yep. NoScript, my personal choice, you block Origin, which mm-hmm. is a very good free ad blocker. It will, boom, just block that script, and you won't be generating Bitcoin or Ethereum for anybody. But on the other hand, your website is already using up a lot of your CPU, right? Browsers are notorious for using up a lot of juice, just displaying images and all that stuff. You're not using it. You're visiting a website. There are many ways to monetize a website. That World War I land ships, you know, cost money for the people who run it. Maybe they put ads there. Maybe they don't. I think actually having a little JavaScript trying to mine little Ethereum while you're on that web page, and it only does it while you're on that web page, is not a bad trade-off.
There's no ads. I wouldn't mind that as long as they told me. If they told me, then that makes it my decision. It's, well, if I don't want this content, I don't have to do that. But if you have me visit thinking that it's just like every other website, and now you're using my CPU power in the background, I feel violated. I'm not a big fan of
that. So maybe our advice would be to cut websites like the World War I Landship site, just to put up a little banner that says, by the way, thank you so much for visiting. Costs us money to run this site. It's a volunteer effort, but we do have to pay something.
Yeah.
So we're, instead of showing you ads, we're going to just run a little script on your site that'll give us the chance of making a little bit of money generating a cryptocurrency. If that's okay with you, click yes. Of course, everybody's going to say no. Everybody's going to say no.
But, I mean, but yes, they will say no, and then you
but, you know, websites are running JavaScript on your site, on your computer all the time, using up plenty of cycles all the time for who knows what.
Now, your solution, however, was to run some sort of ad blocker, which would get rid of the scripts. That's actually quite good. There's a lazier way to do it, the way that I would do it. He said that he knew which sites were trying to exfiltrate data out of his computer or processing power out of his computer. Two easy ways to do it. The first is to use the host file, and there's the equivalent in both Mac and PC, Windows and in Linux, where you would black hole that address. So what was it again? The Coinbase?
CoinHive is one of the big ones.
Yeah. So you would black hole the DNS entry for coinhive.com or .org to like 127.0.0.1.
So you think that's easier than running uBlock Origin?
Well, no, but I mean
it doesn't do ad blocking globally.
Correct.
uBlock Origin is free.
The other way to do it is actually something that I showed you about a month ago, which is the Pi hole. So it's a little Raspberry Pi. Yep. It actually has a blacklist. So you can add a set of sites that you do not want contacted by your computer under any circumstances.
You may not need to. I would bet you anything CoinHive's already in their blacklist.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. You can actually go through the list of over 100,000 sites that Pi-hole already blocks.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is it will actually give you a status window. It will show you which sites are being blocked. And
that's
so that kind of tells you, when I visited this one site, it called 42 other domains. Then you have to start questioning, well, what are those domains doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, and there's also the larger issue, and I'm sure we're going to see this, of, well, if it's doing Ethereum mining, what else is it doing?
That's
There is an escalation in all this. There are now some sites, I don't know if CoinHive is one of them, that will put permanent code on your site, continuing to mine Bitcoin or Ethereum on their behalf. That's not so good either. I guess you're right. It probably is just not a good thing to do
without
permission.
It's not a good thing. And if you're going to do it, seriously, just be above board. If you have a loyal audience, they're not going to mind. If you're a drive-by, then you just shouldn't be doing that.
The problem is we get so much free stuff on the net.
We do.
And we're so used to that. And nobody wants ads, so people run ad blockers. Basically, people do everything they can to keep a site from making money. And I got to tell you, as great as
we do. That's our that's how we make our money.
Everybody needs to pay the rent and buy SpaghettiOs, and you can't do that and have a site for free. So I'm not against sites monetizing. This is a little challenging, but on the other hand, are you not seeing ads? Do you want them to do ads instead? I don't know if they're doing ads. There's no good solution to this. We need a way to monetize.
Be a good net citizen.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's what we're saying.
There are browsers. I like the Brave browser. This is kind of a new thing. The Brave browser lets you buy Bitcoin and then distribute it to the sites that you block. And that's kind of an interesting idea as well. I like the Brave browser quite a bit. So maybe that's another way to do it, is to just say they by default will block all advertising and trackers. I suspect CoinHive does not work in the Brave browser. But what you can do is donate. You can put some money into a bank, and they will automatically pay that money out in small fractions to sites who participate. And I think that's kind of cool, too. So.
Yeah, I think our answer is yes. There are many ways
to block this. Yeah.
The question is, do you actually want to support the places that you go to for your content?
And come on.
Hopefully the answer is yes.
You're doing a site on World War I land ships. There's 1,000 people in the world who want to see your site, right? You put a lot of effort into it. You're paying for a server. And you just want to get the money back out of it. Maybe just ask for donations.
I don't know. I now want to find out about World War II land ships.
World War One land ships.
World War One. I want to find out.
Did they even have ships in 1914?
I think they were just sailing on blocks of ice.
All right. Question two.
Question two. This is from Michael from Woodland Hills, California. And he asks, "Hi, I'm a semi-retired psychiatrist and interested in setting up a podcast." We know a little something about that. "I have had experience in radio and know lots of people in the field who I think would make interesting guests.
Ooh.
My plan would be to interview mostly remotely. I could go by trial and error and figure out how to set it up, but would it be best to find a consultant to help me?"
No.
"What is your advice? Thank you for any assistance." First of all, a consultant, no, don't do that, because we've actually covered that on this network on multiple shows.
You can do it. You're smart.
Yeah. We've actually done it on Know How. We did an entire series on both audio and video podcasts. I know you've covered this on The Tech Guy multiple times. And
so let's say, given the kind of podcast he wants to do, and I think this is probably the most common.
Right.
He wants to do audio only, and he wants to do Skype calls, I guess, Skype with other people or phone calls with other
or,
people.
Or remotely, or go in the field.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood. So he's going to, it's going to be in person.
Right.
Okay, that's even easier. Because mm-hmm. it's a little complicated recording Skype calls, but all you have to do is take your phone, which you already have a very capable recorder, and go out in the field and just go like this. If you want to add a special external mic, you can get a little bit better quality. You can go out and buy a Zoom handy
Zoom
mic.
H4N.
Those are great, the H4N, and that looks like a recorder, so people won't think you're kind of bogus just going like this with your phone. And believe me, appearances are everything when you're going out and interviewing people. And then you just come back home. You can use Audacity, the free editor. It's an open source editor. There it is. That's the H4N. Very nice. What is it, a couple hundred bucks?
If you buy it used, you can get it for $200.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about this is it's got stereo mics that you can rotate. So you can choose the pickup pattern.
It really gives you good recording.
And it also has great two XLR inputs. So if you wanted to expand your podcast and do better mics, that's also possible. It means you're never going to throw this piece of gear away.
Yeah, it's a really great recorder. So you take that little SD card out of there. You put it into a card reader. You put the audio on your computer. You fire up Audacity, a free audio editor. Works very well, Windows, Mac, or Linux. You chop out the beginning, you know, the noises of, hey, I want to interview you. You chop out the end, thanks, it was great interviewing you. And you've got a show.
That's it.
Turning it into a podcast is as simple as finding somebody like Libsyn or somebody to store it. And the nice thing about a company like Libsyn, Libsyn.com, is they'll make a feed out of it for you. They'll give you a website. Now, I'm going to show you something I've been doing lately.
Yes, please.
And this is a little bit cheesier, but a lot easier.
Easy.
That's my motto, cheesy but easy, right? Yeah. Is that my motto?
It is now.
Up with a better motto. It's a company, and I haven't really talked about this yet because it's interesting. So this is a program called Anchor that you put on your smartphone, Windows, iOS, or Android. Anchor.fm is the website. And it allows you to record from your phone, whether it's you or other people. It allows you to put in music. You can actually, and I really like this feature, take questions from your listeners. They can, as they're listening on Anchor.fm, they can leave you a question.
So you get like a call screen.
Yeah, which you can then insert their recording. It's not interactive. And they tell me they've took this feature out, but they're going to put it back in the next few weeks. There's a feature where you can bring up a number pad and make a phone call to somebody, have a conversation with them, and have that be part of your podcast.
Wow.
Now, there are limitations. The way it works right now, you can do 5-minute chunks, but you can do as many 5-minute chunks as you want, and then at the end of the day, combine them all into a real podcast, which they put on iTunes for you, and people can listen to just like any other podcast. So, and this is absolutely free from beginning to end. You don't pay for the storage, you don't pay for the software, you don't pay for the iTunes app. It's very straightforward and simple to use. Ron Richards did some marketing for them, I think, over the summer, so we were kind of aware of this for some time. I set up a little show to do this, and I think it's at least to get started.
Yeah.
The simplest way, you just put it on your phone, you start doing it, you see how you like it. One of the things I like about it, as people listen to it, there's a little applause button, and then when you're listening to somebody else's show, you hear people applauding.
Oh, the feedback's always nice.
I think that's kind of fun. There's some interesting features to this. It's a little janky in places. They've
janky
got some work
okay.
to do.
I mean, here's the thing. If you make it easy, people are more likely to do it.
It is really easy.
You and I both know the thing about a podcast is not making the podcast. It's continuing to do the podcast
day after day, week after week.
Exactly
right. Yeah.
So if I have an app on my phone that does all the hard work, even if it's a little janky, at least it will let me know if this is what I want to do. And then I can invest some money in hardware.
All right. I just posted that right now. That's
just
six. That's you and me.
On the set of the new screen.
Wow, that sounds
Father
really good,
Robert
Leo.
Robert Ballasaire, the Pope's favorite maker. And some amazing.
Well, this is the point, is your phone has a decent mic in it.
Yeah. Iron Man. It looks
I mean, your phone
things.
Is a computer, and your phone is a connected broadcasting device. Right. Why not take advantage of it?
So, you can go out, you can buy some hardware, you can download some software, you can create a podcast, you can upload it to a site like Libsyn, you can turn it into a podcast, and then you can tell the world about it,
or you
can just put this app on your phone.
You could just hit the button.
And play with it. At least start, okay? I wasn't planning on telling everybody. My podcast I've done it for a week, called Leo on the Line, because the idea was I was just going to call people and say, hey, it's Leo on the line, and talk to them.
It's actually, he's a high, what do they call those, a slack line walker?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leo is on the line.
He's on a line.
Leo on the line. And then, you know, it's just kind of fun, and it's on iTunes. You can search for it. I haven't really publicized it. Eventually, I'll blog about it. I created a site, Lotl Fun, L-O-T-L, leoontheline.fun. But if you go there, there's nothing much there yet. You have to sign in with Twitter. It's stupid. I'm going to change that. In fact, before this show airs, I'm going to fix that. So L-O-T-L.fun, Lotl Fun. Get it?
Lotl.
I registered that at the Hover. Lotl Fun. That will point to a regular website where you can subscribe to the podcast. Anyway, I don't know. I've just been playing with it. Just kind of, it's audio. It's like, it's not formal. Like everything we do here is fancy. It's not fancy.
I might give it a go for Padres Corner. That could be kind of fun.
You were my inspiration. You were doing Padres Corner, which was all the stuff that you couldn't really put on your other shows. Just kind of offhand stuff, talking to people. That's kind of what I want to do. And I'm waiting for them to get the phone stuff in there so I'll call you up. And just say, hey, Robert, how's the Pope?
They call that a collaboration, folks. Yeah. It's super technical in podcasting. Yeah.
Anyway, hey, that's great. I'm glad that I'm glad we could talk to you, Michael. Good luck. Maybe you could do a little 5-minute psychiatric help. The doctor is in.
I could use it.
Yeah. Are we done?
Oh my gosh.
How did this happen? It was really fun. What a great show. Again, Patrick Norton will be here next week.
Mm-hmm.
We thank our great guests for coming by. I thank you, Father Robert.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
I love doing this show with you. We have a newsletter if you'd like to know ahead of time who's going to be on the show, what we're going to talk about. For all of our shows, twit.tv/newsletter. We do this show Saturday afternoons, about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. If you want to watch us make the sausage, because it's not the full polished version. Sometimes things go wrong. You know, sometimes Leo gets stuck in a helmet. That was really scary for a minute there. You can watch live at twit.tv/live. And if you do that, please join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. That's the kids in the back of the class. We love the chat room. If you don't want to watch live, if you can't watch live, we have audio and video on demand of everything we do. twit.tv is the website. In this case, twit.tv/NSS. And actually, if you go there and download a show and you like it, would you do me a favor? Subscribe in your favorite podcast application. Just, you know, we're there, we're everywhere. Just search for New Screensavers, and that way you'll get every episode the minute it's ready. Thank you, Robert Ballasse.
Thank you, Leo Laporte.
Jesuit. Thanks to you for joining us. Thanks to our great studio audience. It was wonderful having you here today, and we'll see you next time on the New Screensavers. Bye-bye!